a religious movement looks to its seminary for ideas to inform, for ideas to inspire, for thought leadership, to help, to guide, not to command, but to guide action in the trenches, on the ground. And the symposium is a realization of that ideal in practice. We're going to be looking today at the relationship between ideas and actions, between beliefs and behaviors, between meanings and actions. And what I want to do with you is to consider two different models. One is a very contemporary model that you, I'm certain, will be familiar with. This is very much present in popular Jewish conversation. And the other is a more traditional model that is not as well known, but that actually has a lot of grounding in contemporary sociological thinking. You'll see that my position on this is going to go to the both traditional and sociological more than the popular. But what I want to do is really raise the question of how do ideas and meanings relate to each other? And what does that relationship mean for the ways that leaders think about dealing with the challenge of Jewish engagement? Okay, so model one, this is the model that I'm going to assume that you're familiar with. You have heard it said that we are all Jews by choice, and that because we are all Jews by choice, in a moment when everyone is free to choose or not to choose Jewishly, we need to answer the question, why be Jewish? We need to answer that question for ourselves, and we need to answer that question so that we can engage other people. Because if we don't know why this matters to us, how are we going to be able to present to others compelling reasons for why they should be engaged Jewishly? Now, this notion that to deal with the challenge of Jewish engagement, we need to answer the question of why be Jewish is something that comes up periodically, usually after we have a demographic survey and people who have hair tear their hair out about the prospects for American Jewry. It certainly was alive and well, I remember, after the 1990 population survey. I remember a few years after that, Aaron Pankin and I were sitting in a hotel conference room together. It was in Brewster, Massachusetts, on Cape Cod. It was a lovely late August afternoon. And we were there. I was a new graduate student. He was a new PhD student as well. We were there as part of the Wexner Graduate Fellowship, a leadership development program. They spotted him young. And we were sitting in a circle with other rabbinic students and PhD students and cantoral students and students of Jewish education and Jewish communal service. And leading the discussion were Jonathan Mucher, sociologist and educator, and Jonathan Sarna, historian of American Jewry, who we wish refuah shleima to. And we were debating the question, do we need to answer this question of why be Jewish in order to actually go out, do the work as Jewish leaders that we want to do and we need to do? How important is this? And it was a diverse room. It was diverse denominationally. It was diverse politically. There were a lot of different perspectives on this. But even after the 1990 population survey, you know, this notion of we have an assimilating community, and in order to engage the unengaged, we must understand why be Jewish. We have to crack that nut. We have to answer that question. That was present. David Harris, who headed the American Jewish Committee, wrote around the same time about an apocryphal story of a French philosophy professor who gave his 500 students a final exam, and it was a one-word final exam, and that question was, pourquoi? Why? 498 students failed the exam. Long, 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 long answers, and they all failed. The two who got it right gave two-word answers in French. One, pourquoi pas? Why not? Right? And the other, parce que, because. And what Harris said is, okay, maybe, in my parents' generation, maybe, if you ask the question, why be Jewish? You could get away with an answer like, because. Go take that to someone now, someone who's not engaged, someone who's not showing up at the congregation or in the day school. Like, oh, why should I do this? Why should I be Jewish? Because it won't work. Maybe it worked then. I'm not even sure if it did. It won't work now. We are all Jews by choice. There is nothing that is forcing any of us to choose Jewish. And in this context, we need to be able to provide a well-articulated rationale of why people should make this choice. Pew study comes along in 2013, in October. In November, the Forward has an article, and the Forward's headline is, "Answer this question, why be Jewish?" To solve the problem of Jewish identity, we must go to the source of identity. Or solve the problem of engagement, we must go to the source of identity. This question comes up again and again and again. You know, I think of our demographic surveys. On the one hand, you could say, you know, this is social science, and there's supposed to be a cumulative march of progress where we're building on the shoulders of giants and our knowledge is advancing. And that's true, but at the same time, we read these things as Jewish texts. You know, this is a ritual reading. Every 10 years, we get a Rosh Hashanah for statistics, you know, where we essentially reenact the story of the spies. They go into Canaan, and they come back, and they report, mostly with trepidation. Some say, we can handle this. Some with optimism. But there's an enduring tension. There's an enduring tension. And the surveys, we deal with the same questions because this is looking to the future. We're looking with hope. We're looking with fear. And our new Jewish texts, these demographic surveys, give us the opportunity to deal with these questions again and again. So we get the new demographic survey, and again, we're in an age of choice. We must answer the question, why be Jewish, to address the problem of engagement. Okay. So there is a model that relates behavior to action in this. And it's a model that says that ideas will lead to action. We need to be able to understand what underlies why we do what we do in order, one, to protect ourselves, because we all change. We're on journeys, right? And if we're not clear to ourselves as why we're doing what we're doing, we may stop doing it, and so that we can convince others. Okay, it's very appealing. And think about why it's appealing. I told you to give you some numbers. We are a highly educated population, as you well know. Pew tells us, what, 6 out of 10 American Jews attend college, have an undergraduate degree, twice as much as the population at large. Almost 3 out of 10 Jews have an advanced degree, 3 times as much as the population at large. Okay, so this notion that we can rationally solve this, we can understand why we should be Jewish, we can make a compelling case, it will be logically convincing, it's all very logical, it's very rational, it's very appealing to the well-trained scientific mind such as we have. That's one model. It's a popular model. You've heard this before, yes? This is not the first person who's saying to you, you know, people are saying, why be Jewish, right? Okay. There's another model. And for this, I want to go back to text. And this is from Shemot. This is from the book of Exodus. Vayavo Moshe v'yisaper la'am et kol divrei Adonai v'et kol ha'mishpatim v'yan kol ha'am kol echad v'yomru kol ha'dvarim asher diber Adonai na'aseh dot. And Moses came and told the people all the words of Adonai and the ordinances, and all the people answered with one voice and said, all the words which Adonai has spoken, na'aseh, we will do. Moses then writes the words, they offer sacrifices, and then the text goes on. And he, Moses, took the book of the covenant and read in the hearing of the people, and they said, all that the Lord has spoken, na'aseh v'nishma. Na'aseh, we will do, v'nishma, and we will hear, and we will obey, and we will understand, variously translated. Traditional interpretations of the text which proceed from the notion that this is divine word of God, because it is divine, there's no word out of place. There's no letter out of place. And every word can be used to teach something. So it's a strange thing. You would think here there is a wall that's being presented. And the response is not, okay, well, let's hear what it is, and then we're going to do it, and then we'll do it. It's, okay, we'll do it, and then we'll hear what it is. It seemed to be reversed. And rabbis, I think, were attuned to this because the fact that this is counterintuitive. There's a midrash that they tell. Before God gave the Torah to the Israelites, he went to the other nations of the world to offer the Torah. And so he goes to the Edomites, the children of Esau, and he says, here's the Torah. Do you want it? They say, Nishma, let us hear. Let's hear what's in it. And God says, well, it says, Lo tritzach, thou shalt not murder. See, look, you know, we're Edomites. That's what we do. No, thank you. We don't want it. So he goes to the Ammonites and the Moabites. And if you know anything about the name Ammon and Moab, son of my kinsman from my father, and the biblical story tells, you know, this comes from the incestuous relationship between Lot's daughters and Lot. So here it is. Well, what does it say? Well, thou shalt not commit adultery. Oh, thank you. No, thank you. Not for us. Take it to the Israelites. Okay, we'll take it. Na'aseh. We'll take it. We'll do it. And we will understand. Twice we will do. Na'aseh. Na'aseh. V'nishma. Understanding comes. Hearing comes. But it comes after action. It comes through action. Now, this is a different model that relates action and behavior than the why be Jewish model, which says, first you understand why, then you can explain it, and then you can encourage people to do it. This is different. This one says, do it first. And the meaning is going to emerge from the process of doing it. There are other rabbinic approaches that say the same thing, mitoch shelo lishma ba lishma, from if you begin doing an act, not for the right reasons, the reasons you should be doing it. You can eventually come to doing this for the right reasons. I teach at Vanderbilt, and we have a lot of college students who are enrolling in classes because they have to fulfill their distribution requirements. Okay, they're not necessarily in the Shakespeare class because they love Shakespeare, but they take the class, and guess what? They discover that fact they love it. So they can come to this. They do it first for whatever reason. And they come to it. Okay, so we have two different models. Okay, a why be Jewish model and a na'aseh v'nishma model. And I want to step back and look at these two models and think about the deeper social theory that they're suggesting here. And what then we can learn about Jewish leadership from this. The why be Jewish model. Meaning motivates action. The na'aseh v'nishma model, action generates meaning. Meaning motivates action. It makes sense, it's logical. You think about it in terms of 20th century social theory, and there's a tiny, tiny, tiny problem with that. Meaning generates action. And that tiny, tiny, tiny problem is named Sigmund Freud. You think you know why you do what you do? Have you spent 10 years in therapy yet? Freud introduces us to the notion of the subconscious, to the notion that our motives are not immediately accessible to us. Okay, so we could try. We can try to explain why we do what we do, why be Jewish, and come up with reasons. Well, in this hyper-individualistic world, this provides community. Or with all this rapid change where even kids are not on Facebook anymore because that's for old people already, old being 25 and older, right? Judaism gives stability and some anchor in tradition. Or in this globalized world where we're always moving all over the place. How many are from Cincinnati here? Okay, two. Everyone else came, right? We're moving all over the place. Why be Jewish? Because no matter where you go, you can find community. We have good reasons and good rationales, very nice, and they work. Is this why we do what we do? But the reasons that we ourselves engage in this are so deep and so complex and so fraught. And to think that we can solve this problem rationally and then lay out the case to people who are not engaged so that they will then... No. Not after Freud. Maybe before. Not after Freud. We can't know. Na'aseh v'nishma. Action generates meaning. There are all these unquotable French social theorists from the 1970s, Foucault and Bourdieu and Desserteau, who talk about practice and habitus. And take this idea that meaning is something that we construct through the actions that we do. This, by the way, also, there are traditional echoes to this. As a sociologist, I'm a social constructionist. That means that I believe that we as people create our reality that we're living in. There's an anthropologist named Clifford Geertz who explained it this way. Human beings are like spiders who weave meaning. We weave meaning, and then we weave these webs of meaning, and then we live on the webs of meaning that we have created. Social constructionist approach means that right now we are engaged in the act of creating Hebrew Union College. If everyone connected with the institution stopped doing what they were doing, the institution would not exist. It is created and recreated, produced and reproduced from moment to moment by the actions that we collectively do to recreate it. All the things that have been created before are the webs that we're climbing on. They're real. They're actually, and we're reacting to that. But we're carrying it forward. We produce it. The traditional echo comes in the morning prayer, HaMechadesh B'tuvo B'chol Yom Tamid. It's a vision of God as creator, where creation is not a one-time act. God created and done. No, God is every moment renewing the act of creation. And if God stopped that work, it's all gone. Every instant, the world is being created. So with this traditional conception, and this contemporary sociological conception that we create the worlds that we live in, our actions create our worlds, and the actions that we engage in create the worlds in particular ways. So when we change the way that we act, the meanings that we generate, the nishma, becomes different. Change the na'aseh, the nishma will become different. I'll give you two examples, and then I'll stop talking, and then we'll start discussing. Okay. What's the difference between a Haggadah and a Seder? Is a Haggadah a Seder?
No.
Why not?
It's not the people.
Not the people. Okay. Others? Is a Haggadah a Seder?
Seder is an older guy.
It's a guide.
Would manage to be in the class of Seder, but it's not a prayer book.
Okay. If I gave you Haggadah, do we have a Seder there? What do we need for the Seder? Okay.
The accessories.
Okay. We got to do it, right? If we don't do it, all we have is a script, right? My uncle's going to be acting King Lear in Connecticut in the summer. I'm reading King Lear now with my son. We're reading the script. The play is the performance, and we're going to see that. There's a difference between a script and a performance. And the meaning that gets generated at a Seder is not just the official meanings that are encoded in the Haggadah. The meanings come from each unique, every performance is unique. Because every time you get together, it's a new moment. You know, this is Heraclitus, you don't step in the same river twice. So even if you go back to the same place with the same people, you're a year older. The context in which you're doing it is different. So think about the difference in the meanings that emerge from a Seder when it's the first Seder that you're going to, where the older generation that had always run the Seder is no longer doing it, the torch has been passed. Or it's the first Seder that you're attending where your kid is old enough to know the four questions and it's four questions, and is the one to ask it. The meanings are different. I think about different Seders I've experienced. You know, the year that we were spending in Israel away from the family, we were with a friend whose family came from Iraq. It was a Passover Seder, but it meant something different to me by being in that. I think of the year that my cousin brought his banjo to the Seder, and we sang everything to the banjo. It meant something different. So you have a script, and the script can be fixed, but every time you enact it, you're enacting it in a unique way, and unique meanings get generated. Okay, that's on the small level, but this matters on the big level too. 1974, imagine that you are engaging the Jewish people. You're imagining yourself connected to other Jews. And the way that you're imagining it is because you're actually doing something that creates in your mind a sense of what that Jewish collective is. You're out on Solidarity Sunday and you are marching on behalf of Soviet Jews. You are out there and you're saying, we are one and I am my brother's keeper. You're imagining a Jewish people that's united, and the main act that you're doing that imagines the Jewish people in this unified way is a public political act. Okay, but now come back with me to Cape Cod. The first time that Aaron and I met, and we were also imagining a Jewish people, but we were doing something very different, and the image of the Jewish people that emerged out of that was a very different image. So here we're sitting. We're not in public. We're in private. We're not proclaiming we are one. We're talking across denominations, and we're encountering a lot of diversity, and we're trying to work through that diversity in these conversations. Both of these actions, marching in public and sitting in private cross-denominational conversations, imagine a Jewish collective, but they imagine it differently. One imagines a unified Jewish people by engaging people in public political action. Another imagines a diverse Jewish people by engaging people in private, intimate conversations to engage Jewish diversity. What happened to Jewish peoplehood? What happened to Jewish peoplehood is that the way that we enact Jewish peoplehood has changed. We stopped doing one type of actions, we started doing another type of actions, and the way that we think about what it means to be a people changes. So what does this mean as we think about Jewish engagement and leading for Jewish engagement? We don't need to be in our heads, and we don't need to rationally figure out why be Jewish and then make the case logically. An Aseh V'Nishma approach would say, create ways of doing Jewish. Whatever's meaningful to you. You don't even have to know why it's meaningful to you. Whatever is meaningful. Create ways of doing and invite people to join. Not everyone's going to join. Not everyone's going to join in every action. But in the course of doing, meanings will emerge. The meaning will come. Thank you. The meanings change. The meanings that engage, that capture people change from time to time. And in part, it's based on who they're doing it with and how else it's playing in the broader culture. There were moments when social action was very important. There were moments when other things took the fore. I don't make an argument that there's any single essence. But if people are finding that when they're doing this, this is a meaningful action to them, you know, that's great, and capitalize on it and build on it. But
for us, we're thinking of it as a significant way to experiment for youth engagement.
Yeah, certainly, and they don't necessarily need to get in because they have a pre-existing commitment to social justice. All right, and that the why be Jewish is the mistake of the why be Jewish approach is to say, look, why be Jewish because this is a path to making the world a better place, and you should be committed to this and do it. You can get him. No, your friend is coming. Come, you know, come do this and make this meaningful. Make this meaningful for yourself in your own way. And the way that it's meaningful for me, when I'm doing the same activity, right? We're, you know, building the same house, right? It's, you know, it's meaningful for me in a different way than it's meaningful for someone else. Yeah. Yes, and then yes. Ask yourself this question: do you always come to the same answer? And if you ask yourself the question, you know, months apart, years apart, decades apart, my guess is you're not. My hope is that you're not. There's a continual engagement with it. There's much more to why we do what we do than we have access to. And the reasons change and evolve, and we may not always be fully aware. I don't think that we have to solve the question. I don't think we have to solve the question. I'm not saying to not ask it. We should ask it. It's a meaningful question to ask. But it's something that we need to first address in order to get out there and do things. I don't think we need to do that. I think we can create ways of acting that are meaningful for us, that are meaningful for others, and bring people in, and it will generate meanings of its own in ways that will spin off that we won't know. But that's a good thing. That's a good thing. Thank you.
Thank you.